From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on This Day in Maine, Tuesday, October 10th, 2017. And on this day, Anthony Sanborn is back in court in Portland after serving almost 30 years in prison for murder. And Maine environmentalists react to the proposed rollback of the federal Clean Power Plan. That's all ahead in just a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by Norway Savings, supporting the colorful vision of Maine's business owners. Live your life in color. NorwaySavings.bank.
A man who has spent nearly 30 years in prison for a murder he says he didn't commit was in Cumberland County Court today for a hearing to determine whether he can go free. Anthony Sanborn and his attorneys allege he was convicted after the state mishandled evidence and threatened witnesses in his original trial. But the state argues that a jury reached the correct verdict 25 years ago. Patty White has more.
The crime at the center of this case is the murder of 16-year-old Jessica Briggs. In 1989, she was stabbed to death on what's now known as the Maine State Pier, and her body was dumped into the harbor. 3 years later, Briggs' ex-boyfriend, Anthony Sanborn, who was also 16 at the time of the murder, was convicted of the crime. Sanborn has always professed his innocence, and last April, he was released on bail after a key witness recanted her testimony. At Sanborn's post-conviction hearing at Cumberland County Unified Criminal Court on Tuesday, his attorney, Amy Fairfield, said police and prosecutors targeted Sanborn early in their investigation and suppressed evidence and manufactured facts to win a conviction.
They built their case block by block, puzzle piece by puzzle piece, and they made it fit.
Fairfield accused the state of a, quote, systematic obliteration of Sanborn's due process rights. She reminded the court that Sanborn has vehemently denied any involvement in Jessica Briggs' murder. Having served 27 years of a 70-year sentence, Fairfield said the now 45-year-old Sanborn deserves to be freed.
So we're asking the court to vacate the jury's verdict, and we're asking the court to find Anthony Sanborn actually innocent because he is actually innocent.
The state denies any wrongdoing in the case. In his opening statements, Assistant Attorney General Paul Ruscha said if the defense is correct that Sanborn was wrongfully convicted, it would indicate a massive and unlikely cover-up by police, the Attorney General's office, and others involved in the case.
To believe that, Your Honor, you have to believe that a lot of good people are involved in doing something to this man that people have never met.
Ruscha says that Sanborn was a reasonable suspect to pursue because he was Briggs' ex-boyfriend and he could be placed around the pier the night of the murder. In terms of evidence that was mishandled or suppressed, Ruscha cautioned that current standards for record-keeping and investigations, which use computers, should not be applied to a 30-year-old case. He also emphasized that evidence has already been presented in this case and a jury delivered a finding.
There were 12 that found him guilty in 1992, and we would ask that the court respect that verdict.
Sanborn and his attorneys face a high burden to undo a nearly 30-year-old conviction. Justice Joyce Wheeler says that it's not enough for Sanborn to merely show, with the evidence presented in this hearing, that a different verdict is possible.
There must be a probability that a new trial would result in a different verdict.
Justice Wheeler also noted that the results of the hearing could have a profound impact on a number of affected parties. Jessica Briggs' family, who thought they had closure, Anthony Sanborn and his family, and finally, the public.
I hope this proceeding will be one in which the confidence of the justice system is underscored and sustained. And that confidence is not lost because of what may or may not be done here.
The first witness, Assistant Attorney General Donald Maycomber, who was part of the prosecution team in Sanborn's original trial, testified that he never saw police or other prosecutors pressure witnesses. He also read a transcript of a 2015 interview with Hope Cady, the witness who recanted her testimony, where she said Sanborn was not innocent. More than 60 other witnesses are listed for the hearing, which will run through October 25th. Then, Justice Wheeler will decide whether Sanborn's conviction will stand or be thrown out. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
This week, Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt proposed repeal of the Clean Power Plan, the cornerstone of the Obama administration's efforts to address climate change. While it is not unexpected, the decision is coming under fire as ideologically driven and a boon for the fossil fuel industry and a critical time for the planet. Susan Sharon has more.
Considered one of the signature policies of President Barack Obama, the Clean Power Plan is designed to significantly cut greenhouse gas emissions from power plants by 2030. It also sets specific targets for states to meet and a flexible framework for doing so. Pruitt has long held that it's illegal. "We are committed to righting the wrongs of the Obama administration by cleaning the regulatory slate," he said in a statement. "Any replacement rule will be done carefully, properly, and with humility by listening to all those affected by the rule."
What we have is a clean power plan. What we're getting is a dirty power plan.
During a telephone news conference, David Doniger of the Natural Resources Defense Council was quick to attack Pruitt as President Trump's deregulatory lieutenant, someone who has cooked the books and the science to try to make it appear that the plan is costly and without environmental benefits.
When in fact the science is extremely strong that the carbon pollution benefits and the soot and smog benefits drastically outweigh the shrinking cost of meeting this plan.
Maine's geographical location at the end of the tailpipe makes it vulnerable to polluting industry emissions from the Midwest. And Lisa Pullman of the Natural Resources Council of Maine says that has harmful consequences beyond just dirty air.
It all comes our way, and it makes for very bad air days and exacerbates asthma attacks and, frankly, damages our economy because it is all producing a warmer climate, and that's not good for our fisheries, it's not good for our farmers, it's just not good.
Pruitt used an event in Hazard, Kentucky Monday to announce his proposal to repeal the Clean Power Plan. "The war on coal is over," he said. But critics, including the Union of Concerned Scientists, point out that more than a third of the nation's coal-fired electricity is either already slated to go offline or is more expensive to operate than existing natural gas plants. And they say allowing power plants' carbon emissions to go unchecked will create uncertainty in the burgeoning renewable energy market and stall investments. Richard Kaufman is New York State's energy czar.
In New York State, one of the fastest-growing jobs categories is in clean energy, but we will lose this race globally if we're not careful, because other countries are embracing the future as opposed to trying to turn the clock back.
It could take months for the Trump administration to come up with a replacement plan, which environmental groups are likely to challenge in court. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
It's no secret that populations are shrinking in some of Maine's isolated island communities like North Haven and Monhegan. More and more island residents are often older, with no kids, and present only during the warmer months. And that's posed a challenge for some of Maine's island schools, which were small to begin with. But as Robbie Feinberg reports, some islands are trying a new approach by luring in students from the mainland.
For junior Finn Gibson, getting to class every morning is a little bit of an adventure. It starts early, on a bus from his hometown of Belfast. The bus takes him to a ferry terminal in nearby Lincolnville, and Finn then takes the half-hour boat ride across Penobscot Bay to the island of Islesboro. Then it's one more bus ride before finally Finn gets to school on the island. The commute can make for a long day, often nearly 10 hours.
That's if you have no extracurriculars. If you have soccer practice, you get home at 6:45. It's quite a long day when you get down to it. It's like 2.5 hours of commute total all day.
But it's a journey that Finn and about 20 other students choose to make to the Islesboro Central School, a large stone building that has only about 90 students from kindergarten through 12th grade. But Principal Heather Knight says it's enough to keep the school's culture vibrant. 10 years ago, she says, there were concerns that the island school was becoming too small.
You know, when you have a classroom discussion of two, it's not as diverse. The diverse thinking isn't there, the ideas aren't bouncing off, or they bounce and they land, and there's no bouncing.
Knight says the community recognized that it needed to keep the school alive and decided to expand what it called a magnet program, designed to attract students over from the mainland every day.
Adding to the student body in such a way that we could offer full classes with full discussion, that we could offer diverse social experiences.
For some students, coming to a tiny island school is a tough sell. It can't compete with bigger schools when it comes to AP classes or sports. But Islesboro tries to use its tiny size to its advantage.
I mean, we're only in a group of 10. You're not going to hide in the back of the room and not be called on. You're not going to be able to slip through the cracks here. That doesn't happen here. It can't. It's unacceptable.
And that small size also allows the staff here to conduct what's called a personalized pathways meeting with every student every year.
We're going, what I'd like us to do for real, Emily, is review what you said last year and sort of see where we are. So
today, the school's guidance counselor, Jess Woods, is sitting down with a junior named Emily Lau. They gather around a table along with a team of teachers and administrators. The goal is to simply talk about what Emily's interested in and how they can make school better for her.
Why don't we start with your vision and see what you said and what you think is still true.
Let's see.
Emily rolls off a long list of interests. She likes math, physics, sailing, poetry, music, and she wants to do it all. So her teachers ask her, what can we do to help you now?
Have you taken any off?
I would add more emphasis to math, actually.
Okay.
No.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, I've always liked math, but I've kind of recently been getting into, like, super competition math. Like, I really like it a lot. It's so much fun. And challenging and stuff, so I like to do that more.
By the end of the meeting, the teachers have talked about a new math class in Emily's schedule, and there are even discussions about planning for some potential future careers. Students say they appreciate this attention, though they say they can't get away with much. Emily laughs as she explains that she's had the same English and math teachers for 5 years, and that her English teacher is actually her mom. But the school says this connection leads to positive results in the classroom, including a school-wide graduation rate that routinely hits 100%. But Islesboro has struggled in meeting one of the major goals of the magnet program, which is to get more working families to move to the island. Because of limited housing options, says Knight, only one family has actually made the move.
But they've been the only ones to successfully pull that off. And it is the lack of housing, appropriate housing choices, that have made that transition for more of our families more possible.
Town officials say they're now addressing that issue through new initiatives like adding broadband to the island and changing zoning laws to allow construction of more affordable housing. And other communities are now attempting this magnet strategy as well. Just this year, the island of North Haven has created a residential program for about a half dozen students from Maine and other countries. And it has a similar goal, using education as a way to replenish the island community's year-round population. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And education reporting on Maine Public Radio, supported by a grant from the Nellie Mae Education Foundation. For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Tuesday, October 10th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.